Greetings, dear Earthlings, and anyone in the universe listening. You are listening to Horror Nerds at Church, a ridiculously queer podcast where we take a deep dive into a horror film or space film and talk about how it connects to queerness, religion, and theology. My name is Pace Warfield, and I am in desperate search for a death stick dealer. It looks really fun.
Uh-oh. And I'm Pastor Emily, and I am the everlasting meme of Padme's one glimmering moment of recognition of Anakin's potential for evil.
She really has that moment, and then she just ignores it.
We'll get into all the comp-heading soon enough. Also, happy birthday to the coolest six-year-old I know, whose birthday is the day this comes out for all of you.
Also.
And past guest. That six-year-old is, in fact, a past guest on this podcast for our BooTube Vampirina episode.
Yeah. Happy birthday to you. And also, happy belated birthday to our podcast, because our podcast turns 3 on March 25th. So this
Woo-hoo! Comes out 3 happy days birthday. After. To us.
Yay.
Speaking of awesome Patreon BooTubes, follow us on Patreon at patreon.com/horrornerdsatchurch. Starting at only $5 to sign up, it is much cheaper than any six-year-old birthday celebration anybody could ever dream up. Dropping this month on Patreon, in addition to the Vampirina BooTube from last year, dropping this month on Patreon, you have hopefully gotten, or in the next 3 days you will get, our BooTube episode on the Ahsoka arc within the Clone Wars show, the Predators movie commentary, and our Horror Buffs, which is our $10 level, will also get, on top of that, our special episode on the Clone Wars film, which, in fact, I am going to watch sometime between now and when we watch episode 3, because I just feel like it needs to happen, just like I'm going to watch Rogue One after episode 3.
I love it. Also, if you have time, I would suggest you watch Gendy's Clone Wars 2D animated. It's no longer canon, but it is also very beautiful and very good. And it's the first on-screen appearance of people like, what is her name? The Count Dooku's apprentice. I can't remember her name.
Oh. Is it a movie?
Asajj Ventress. There we go.
Yeah, Asajj. I was like, it starts with a V, but.
But yeah, Gennady Tarkovsky's Clone Wars series. It's on Disney Plus. If I encourage all of our listeners to watch it too. It's not canon, like I said, but it's not that long. It is.
It is separate from the Clone Wars TV show.
Yeah, yeah. This was a hand drawn, computer animated, TV show that came out in between this movie and Revenge of the Sith, and it aired on Cartoon Network. It was a series of 25 short, like 5 minute or less episodes that would just be like animated shorts that would appear. And it basically was designed to bridge the time in between Clone Wars and Revenge of the Sith. But the reason it became non-canon is when they started working on the computer animated version, they ended up redoing some of the events of the hand-drawn one, and the computer one became the official canon. So, and then when Disney took over, it replaced some of the events of the hand-drawn one as well. So, but it's gorgeous. I love the art style of that. They're gorgeous. And it's short. Like I said, 25 episodes, but each only 5 minutes long. It's not super long thing to watch.
Nice.
But yeah, Disney Plus, you can watch it. It's branded under the Star Wars Vintage banner, like all the other non-canon stuff they have on there.
Okay.
So.
Yeah.
How have you been?
Well, it's been a whole 3 days since you and I recorded an episode, so you know.
It's true. It's
been a whole 3 days. It's been good. Our house has gone through being sick, and I tentatively have come out unscathed. So.
Good.
Yeah,
it looks like one of your housemates who I saw briefly was feeling a lot better, so that's good.
Yeah, she was the last one to get it, so it's a very good sign. Yeah, I'm getting ready for my travels, which is why we're recording all the things all at once. But getting ready for my travels to visit a friend, and in fact, on this day, yesterday, as of when this is going to air, I will have surprised the 6-year-old. By coming to visit for her birthday.
Oh, that's very sweet.
I'm very excited to surprise this.
I didn't realize it was a surprise trip for her. Which is super exciting.
Yeah. I imagine like everybody else knows.
That's
all the grown-ups know all of that, but
yeah.
Yeah. It's exciting. Cool. How have you been?
Been okay. I've been reading. The weather went through a drastic change today, which most people are celebrating. It's in the 60s today. Wonderful temperatures, but I'm not celebrating it because it is affecting my head really badly.
Yeah.
But it is a lovely day outside. I watched Apollo 13, which you can listen to that movie commentary with on our sibling podcast, Nerds at Church's Patreon.
Yeah.
That was fun.
That should be out by now.
I was invited last minute, and it was fun.
Yeah, it was really fun. I enjoyed it. And did you know, didn't realize this until we were recording, and I looked it up while we were recording, but Katherine Goebel Johnson of Hidden Figures fame, and for whom there is a NASA building now named, and who won the Medal of Freedom, actually, her calculations for single star navigation were super helpful in making sure that Apollo 13 safely made it home, even though she appears nowhere in the movies because racism and misogynoir.
I did know that because you mentioned it in the recording, but I'm sure our listeners, it may be a surprise to them.
Catherine it's one Johnson of the fun things that you get if you become a Patreon supporter for Nerds at Church.
I most recently, for our Doctor Who run through, for those of you listening at home, so you can kind of see where I'm at in that, I most recently watched the second Doctor special, The Abominable Snowman, and I watched the 10th Doctor episode, 2-part episode with Martha and Donna, where they, the Doctor's daughter, where they go out into outer space and the Doctor has a clone kind of made out of him that's his daughter. So that's where I'm in my watch through.
I am not in that spot because I'm taking it a little slower than you are, but I
and you also
am.
Started later too.
Vicky just left the Doctor because she could only handle so much of Steven's ridiculous sexist misogyny.
Right.
Before she had to leave. So she just left to go be in Greece, where she's going to be in ancient Greece, where she's going to be treated better than Steven treated her.
Right.
And just watched Love and Monsters, So still in the 10th Doctor and Rose arc. But it's the one I somehow missed. I don't remember this one. I have to have seen it, but I don't remember it. But it's like got some creepy... there's like weird creepy...
I hate that episode.
Yeah. But I am super excited because the next time I watch, which is potentially later today, I get to start Torchwood.
Ooh, yeah.
So that's the real important where I'm at is Torchwood begins. Bwahaha. I've always wanted to watch Torchwood and like Sarah Jane Adventures and stuff alongside with the like crossovers. So I'm excited to be doing that.
Yep. Just a reminder / warning, the first season of Torchwood is trash, but it gets better.
I mean, I have seen Torchwood before.
Yeah.
So.
As far as what I'm reading, today I just finished Our Lives Matter, Woman is Queer Theology by Pamela R. Lightsey, and also Queering Wesley, Queering the Church by Keegan Osinski, and both of those are queer Methodist engagements with queer theory and queer theology. And they're both pretty good. So it's kind of fun to read. I didn't know that Our Lives Matter was also from a Wesleyan perspective. So it's kind of fun to discover that as I was reading. And Queering Wesley, Queering the Church does make use of Our Lives Matter too. So it's also fun to see how that was woven into Keegan Osinski's work. So that's what I've been reading.
I am working on finishing Ellie Engel Saves Not the World but Herself, because it is going to be automatically returned to the library in like a day and a half, so I have like 2 hours left. I should be able to do it.
Yep, you got this.
And I just got in the mail the other day Cole Arthur Riley's book Black Liturgies.
Ooh, yeah.
Prayers, Poems, and Meditations for Staying Human. So I'm really excited to dig into that more. And of course, I'm working my way through Star Wars Return of the Jedi from a certain point of view, which I'm making progress on. So
yay.
We probably will not have the episode recorded by the time this one airs, but that should be... I should have the book finished by about the time this airs.
Yeah.
That's my plan. It's a really good one. I keep reading stories and I'm like, oh my gosh, I want this one.
I know.
I think I have mine set, but we'll see if that changes before I get to the end.
Past From a Certain Point of View episodes for our book club. If you listen to those, you may remember that Emily and I each chose two stories, and then we did a combined third story on the Wills. But this one, there were so many good stories that I just bumped mine up to three and invited Emily to do the same. And we'll still do the Wills story in addition to that, so we'll do a total of seven stories as opposed to five. But there were just It'll too many great. Good ones.
It's true. Yeah. And that's like, there are some that I'm like, this one's awesome. I love this story. Even though I'm not picking it, but I just love it.
Yeah, there were very, like, in some of the past, I will say, From a Certain Point of View overall, all the stories are consistently good. There's only been like maybe one or two out of the 80 stories in the first two volumes that I was like, I don't like that one. But they're all really good. But for some reason, Return of the Jedi, the stories are just like continually, as I was reading through, like just continually blowing me out of the water with how amazing they were and how much I wanted to talk about them more. So,
yeah, it's true.
So we will. So when you finish that, we'll have read 120 Star Wars stories.
That's a lot.
When you think about it that way.
Yeah.
Cool. Indeed, well, indeed. We'll fit that into the schedule somewhere whenever we record it.
Well, and once I get back, I think we'll be on our between season break for Nerds at Church, so that should help.
Yeah.
It'll be nice to have a breather.
Yep. That's what I love so much about us being able to take a break during the WGA and SAG after strikes. It's just real nice to get a little bit of a breather for us too.
And to slowly get ahead. I like being able to like still record stuff, but more casually, or like I really love doing all of our movie commentaries at once. That was fantastic. It's like, this is great.
I would love for that to be an annual tradition of some sort, but I don't know how that would work. But
yeah, we'll figure it out.
Yeah. Well, we are covering Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones, today. Directed by George Lucas. Came out 2002 when I was a sophomore in high school, I want to say.
I was either in my first spring of my first year or fall of my sophomore year.
Came out in May of 2002.
So the end of my first year of high school.
So, yeah.
End of my I actually know a bunch of these movies.
Yeah. So this was a big year for movies. So in 2002, we saw Spider-Man. The Tobey Maguire one, A Walk to Remember, and The Sweetest Thing. I want to throw those both in there because that is kind of the context for the cishet romance films in this era, that which this movie also kind of is.
I really like A Walk to Remember. I'm not sure if I saw The Sweetest Thing, but
yeah, Sweetest Thing is more comedy, more heavy on the comedy side, but still very much a rom-com. Kissing Jessica Stein, which is a delightfully queer film and highly recommend to everybody. Ice Age. Clockstoppers. I include this movie because I love this movie, even though it's a Nickelodeon original movie. It's not very good, but it has a special place in my heart. My Big Fat Greek Wedding. The Bourne Identity. I included just for Emily because I know they...
I love Bourne Identity.
Yep.
I imagine it's super problematic on a number of levels, but I love it.
Lilo and Stitch, The Santa Claus 2, Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, 007 Die Another Day, Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, and Gangs of New York.
So I like almost 10. There's a couple that I'm not sure about, but like the vast majority of those I have read.
And to be clear to our listeners at home, I don't pick every movie. I just kind of try to pick a fair representation of the bigger box office ones, the more well-known ones, and then also the ones I'm pretty sure Emily has seen, or ones that I know that either I or Emily or friends of the podcast have said that they like. So if I don't mention a movie that you love that came out that year, that's why. But
feel free to send us an angry email or message on social media and let us know. And then we can include it next time.
Yep. In the sci-fi world, though, there are three like kind of big movies that came out this year, kind of tying in with the sci-fi theme of the season. So we had Minority Report, Men in Black 2, and Star Trek Nemesis.
I think I saw Minority Report.
Tom Cruise.
Or my sibling did, but there's like a thing with the eyes that like...
Yep, that's Minority Report. And then in the horror world that came out this year, all of these are very porous categories, but I just kind of put them that way. But we had The Mothman Prophecies, Queen of the Damned, rest in peace to Aaliyah. And Queen of the Damned, by the way, is a sequel to Interview with the Vampire, which we covered in season 3.
I didn't know that.
Resident Evil, Blade 2, which we have a movie commentary on.
Yeah.
The Scorpion King, which is a spinoff of The Mummy, which we covered in season 1. Jason X of the Friday the 13th franchise, which we covered in season 2. The live-action Scooby-Doo film, which we have a boo to on the original cartoon show. American Psycho 2, Halloween Resurrection, which we also covered in season 1. Signs by M. Night Shyamalan.
I've seen
and
that one.
The Ring, which we covered in season
1. Oh my gosh. That one was so scary. When they, like, literally, this is how susceptible I am to jump scares. The click when they turned the closet doorknob made me jump.
Love it.
So did the spiders in Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. So,
yeah.
You know.
So, a lot of big ones that came out this year. It's a pretty big year in film history.
Mm-hmm.
But All's Right with the World, you seem to have seen significantly more of the non-horror ones. I use in air quotes.
That's because I was in high school. And that's really all you do in high school besides ski. But you're in school most of the time for the best skiing, so.
I didn't know you were a skier. I love skiing.
Mostly snowboarder, but I also did Nordic when I was in high school.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when was the first time you saw this movie?
In high school. What?
Did you see it in theaters?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, I don't really remember, but I know I did.
So no drinks for anyone, I guess, because I saw it after 12 and Emily saw it before recording this episode.
Mm-hmm. My condolences, folks. Don't worry. We'll get it back.
I mean, drink if you
Aliens
want.
Aliens is next.
Make up your own rules. And it's yes, true. That too. I have a little bit behind the scenes. There's not much here beyond what we already talked about in the first one. But
that George Lucas is racist and yes. Should not have been given free reign.
Yes. But the backlash of the first film, Phantom Menace, was really discouraging to the cast and crew and also to George Lucas himself. So this movie really kind of took a slow start in coming together, in part because George Lucas, I think, and some of the other production members were just almost ready to throw in the towel. We talked about that a little bit after in our Phantom Menace behind the scenes of just how much, like, even the actors and stuff just really felt so discouraged and stuff. And I read a quote by Ewan McGregor about playing Obi-Wan and just like how much he loves Star Wars, but then Star Wars kind of the fan reaction to those movies broke his heart. And it wasn't really until the Obi-Wan TV show that he was able to re-engage with the series and find some measure of healing from it. So,
which sucks because Obi-Wan is one of the redeeming qualities of this movie.
See, now you're beginning to understand my love for Obi-Wan.
It's true. It's true.
And also, let me just quick look up his name so I can get it right.
I prefer Samuel L. Jackson's purple lightsaber.
Yes.
And if I had a lightsaber, it would also be purple.
Okay, so Ahmed Best, who played Jar Jar Binks, also received so much backlash and hatred over the character. So he's another one who just really kind of came away from the franchise just really upset and harmed. And it really wasn't until his cameo in his invitation to play a Jedi and in a cameo role in The Mandalorian that he finally has some level of kind of return and love for the franchise again. So
wait, I'm glad that all these play in The Mandalorian.
He was in the scene, the flashback scene where Grogu was in the Jedi temple during the Great Purge and everybody was like killing all the Jedi and stuff. And so Ahmed Best played the Jedi who was able to escort Grogu to safety and die in the process. He gave up his life so Grogu could flee into safety.
Oh, nice.
So
that's awesome. Yeah, they did Jar Jar dirty in this. They manipulated the character of Jar Jar Binks.
Well, we'll get to that because there's a few theories about that.
Oh my gosh, but, is this where we get that Jar Jar is actually a Sith Lord?
This is part of it, yeah. But the working production title of this movie was called Jar Jar's Great Adventure. kind of a FU to fans because of how much fans hated the character that George Lucas and production team were like, we'll just call it Jar Jar's Great Adventure and have that as a working title to see what everyone feels about that. And I kind of love that energy, not going to lie.
I love that energy too, except it like hardly has any Jar Jar in it, and Jar Jar does not go on any great adventures. He just like
he grows on the great adventure of helping to create the empire.
Gosh, that is not great.
Yeah, Samuel L. Jackson, as you mentioned, he wanted a purple lightsaber, and he like petitioned strongly for that because up until now we've only seen blue and green lightsabers, and he's like, I want a purple one. And so they gave him a purple one, which I love.
Me too.
And I love like the coloring of the lightsaber being purple, being a color that in weird division of masculinities and femininities in Western and especially United States culture, that purple tends to be considered a feminine color, but Mace is, Windu is one of the most badass Jedi, and he rocks a purple lightsaber, kind of subtle, like, gender fucking going on there.
Yeah. Which I love. I also associate it a lot with womanist theology. I think it was Alice Walker.
Yeah, when she talks about purple.
Woman is to womanist as purple is to purplish, or, yeah. There's a quote.
Alice Walker, by the way, we do not avow her anti-Semitism. I feel like we have to state that whenever we talk about Alice Walker.
Yeah, I didn't know about it. I love the quote, her book,
The Color Purple. But
yeah. But her, the way she puts it is, womanist is to feminist as purple is to lavender.
No.
And I love that. I do not love anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
And did not realize that. So thank you for the education.
Education. Some fun trivia I like is that Hayden Christensen, who played Anakin, and Ewan McGregor, who plays Obi-Wan, of course, I think both are fantastic actors. People love to hate on Hayden's acting in this, but I don't think it's his acting. I think he does a really good job. I think it's more the writing. George just doesn't do very good with writing lines.
George Lucas just doesn't do very good without other people fixing things.
Yeah. Huh. So
it's like he's not actually good.
Yeah. But if you've ever seen Hayden Christensen's other acting, like he was in this movie called The House or something like that. I can't remember exactly, but like this indie film with his acting was so good. He plays this like kind of queer troubled teen character. So that's always what I think of when I think of how great of an actor he is, but people always love to hate on him. But anyway, Hayden and Ewan both were doing lightsaber sound effects during the filming of this, to the point that many of the takes had to be scrapped because they're like, you can't be making those sounds. We'll add them in post-production. You can't be moving your mouth and stuff and making and sounds and all that stuff.
So I just love that. Love this.
Right.
I'm here for it.
This is also one of the first major Hollywood films to use digital cameras instead of film cameras. So at the time, that was highly controversial. Now, most big budget film productions are shot on digital camera. But at the time, I remember there was like so much like, anytime there's significant change, you know, there tends to be like a lot of fear mongering about it and stuff. It's, this is the end of film as we know it, and end of cinema as we know it. Like,
yeah.
Also cute, kind of like what I was saying about Hayden and Ewan, is Christopher Lee, near and dear to my heart, a great horror actor, played Saruman in Lord of the Rings, and played, he was in, he played Lord Summerisle in Wicker Man that we watched on this podcast for season 4. But he is a real life trained professional. He was a real life trained professional fencer. So he did all of his own sword fighting stunts and stuff in this, which I think is cool, especially because he was in his 80s when he filmed this. And he's able to hold his own pretty well doing that. But then also, in interviews for this film and when his character returns in Revenge of the Sith, one of the things he always said is, I hope I live long enough for the premiere. I'd love to see it, which I just think is so adorable and sweet. And he did. He lived long enough to for the premiere of both of these films. Although he did pass away about 5-10 years ago, somewhere in there. Yeah. And then just as Natalie Portman, just as Keira Knightley played one of Padme's handmaidens in the first film, another big name, Rose Byrne, played one of the handmaidens in this one, Dorme, the one who gets killed on the explosion in the beginning of the movie. But Rose Byrne, we'd know it from Sunshine, which you have seen. Bridesmaids.
Insidious. Bridesmaids is where I knew her face from.
Yeah.
I had to look, though, because she has brown hair in the pictures that show up and it as Dorme. So I did not realize I knew her at all, which like makes sense. They're trying to make her look like Natalie Portman. So.
She always has brown hair, doesn't she?
Not in Bridesmaids.
Oh, I don't remember her hair and the color in that one. But in Sunshine, she had brown hair. I never know that much. Then the last thing I have is there are some novels that kind of expand on the lore of this. There, of course, is the film novelization. That one sticks to the script pretty straightforward. It gets a little bit more of the internal life of Anakin and Padme as they fall in love and stuff, which is helpful because on screen, you're just watching like, why are these two like falling in love? There's nothing. There's like seems to be no chemistry between them. So... Mm-hmm. The book helps a little bit with that, but there's the Queen Trilogy by E.K. Johnston, which follows Padme, the first book follows her rise to becoming a queen, the second one follows her time, the beginning of her time as a senator, the third one follows the towards the end of her career as a senator and eventual death by Anakin. And then Brotherhood by Michael Chen is a great book that takes place immediately. Well, that takes place both before and then immediately after this movie. And it follows Anakin and Obi-Wan's relationship. And it also explains how Obi-Wan became Jedi Master and became on the council, and it also explains how Anakin finally passes the trials and becomes knighted and stuff like that. So it fills in some of those holes. And then there are just many Star Wars Legends novels that are no longer canon but still very much beloved that are set in the Clone Wars era, featuring a lot of Jedi and stuff, doing all the Jedi things. Nice. There are some that focus on Mace Windu, which are cool. There are some that focus on Yoda and all sorts of stuff. So, do you have a one-sentence summary for this movie?
I do. Anakin's an asshat while Padme competes.
Sounds right. That could also probably work for the second one. I mean, for episode 3 as well.
It's true, but...
Yeah.
I feel like episode 3 is a whole different kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mine is Space is Cloned. So you can take a shot for that because mine's shorter or Emily's is longer.
It is true.
I guess we can get into this one. Mm-hmm. Why don't you start us off? Mine are not really organized, so I'll just interject mine as you go.
Perfect. Okay, first off, I don't like Anakin. If this were an alien movie, Anakin would be the first on my list of will be my favorite kill.
Yep.
Because that's the kind of asshat he is.
Yep.
Like, he is the worst.
He is so arrogant, so controlling, so
manipulative, creepy.
Yep.
The whole thing. And we can get into that a little bit more. I feel like misogyny is just always going to be one of our deep dives in this series. So we'll get to that. But I really like that opening scene where Padme is in her residence and sleeping, and then there's like another assassination attempt. I like that whole series.
Yeah.
The car, the like speeder chases, the everything.
And R2 scanning the room. Cute.
Yeah. Which like R2, yay, scanning the room, but would have scanned it better. Like, would have looked at the glass and then probably noticed because of that. Mm-hmm. The like machine thing. But okay, whatever. We gotta like make R2 not as good so that, you know, Anakin can save the day or whatever. But when Anakin and Obi-Wan are talking outside the room, A, it's distracting them. They are not paying their best attention, which is, you know, their job to save her life. So good job. But also, I noticed this time, and I didn't notice it before, that Anakin's talking about Padme's residence as quiet as a tomb. And I was like,
Foreshadowing much?
Do you want her to die? Because, yeah.
Kind of like another line in there where Obi-Wan says to Anakin, you're going to be the death of me one day, or something like that. It's like, yep.
Yeah.
That's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My next one is after your second, is right around your second one. So if you want to do your first, we could just alternate ish.
Yeah. So we get introduced to, so in the first movie, we got introduced to Darth Maul and Darth Sidious. This one, we get introduced to Darth Tyrannus. And it's like, come on with these names, my dude. Like Jesus Christ, can we pick a more on-the-nose name for any of these? And it's like, that always gets to motivation in, like, characters and stuff like that. There are very few people in the world, in real life, that see themselves as evil and are motivated out of intentionally being evil. Most people think that when they are doing evil actions, they have twisted logic or something to think that they're actually doing good or something, even though they're doing evil. So whenever somebody like intentionally names themselves something evil, then it's that to me just feels so cartoonish, because like, why would Darth Sidious name himself in a word that sounds very much like insidious, which is what he is? Why would Darth Tyrannus name himself after being a tyrant? Like,
which he's trying to be.
Yeah, but in his mind, he thinks he is on the side of the separatists, helping to advance the cause of the end of the Galactic Republic, so that way the separatists can have greater freedom. Like, he thinks in his mind he's doing good.
I don't think Palpatine thinks that. I mean, Tyrannus thinks that.
What do you think his motivations are? I have the benefit of reading the book called Dooku, Jedi Lost, which gives some of his motivations. So I don't have as
wait, which much one's of Tyrannus an and which one's read. Sidious?
What? Sidious is Palpatine.
Oh, I was switching.
Tyrannus is Dooku.
Okay, never mind. I was switching them. I was thinking it makes more sense to me for Tyrannus to be the guy who's becoming dictator. So that's where I mixed up their names.
Yeah. But anyway, I just think that's so silly.
That makes sense.
The way I remember it, which is problematic because I don't like to call people ugly or not, but Sidious rhymes with hideous, and after his fall and the Empire and stuff, like, hideous. So that's the way I always remembered it as a kid, for better or worse. Anyway. But then also, when the whole thing about Anakin, this movie is supposed to start to show Anakin's slow fall to the dark side. Which, first of all, I feel like he's already there. But secondly, like, the whole worries about his mom dying and stuff, and then going to Tatooine to rescue her. He goes rescues her, but she dies in his arms, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But he just like full on murders the group of Tusken Raiders.
Okay, but first off, movie death scenes are the worst. That is not how people die and take their last breath. It does not happen to that way. Basically ever.
Right, right.
And then, yes, Anakin just slaughters every single
mentions that he kills the women and the children, which, first of all, as we know from a certain point of view, the Tusken Raiders are a very patriarchal society, so women are subservient to the men and not considered full warriors, which is problematic within their culture and stuff. So, but basically that is a way of saying that Anakin killed even the people not responsible for the torturing and death of his mother and the children and stuff. So, but like, so he wipes out this entire village and then it's never mentioned again. And he tells Padme and she's just like, oh, okay. You must have felt really sad and angry. It's like, he slaughtered people. And you're just like, oh, I'm going to comfort you. I'm so sorry that happened.
Right? And I don't remember if it's Yoda or Mace or both of them, but they realize something is happening. They know something's happening. They can feel it in the Force. And then nobody ever bothers. Like, I know a lot of stuff happens, but like, debrief that shit.
Right? Like, if I were Padme, even if I deeply loved Anakin, like, I know this from my own life, that when I have had somebody I know who I love very deeply doing something harmful, I say I have said to that person, you need to tell this person, or if you don't, I will, because that is a responsibility I have. And so, like, if I were Padme, I would probably be like, Anakin, you need to tell this to Obi-Wan, and if you don't, I will, just because this is a serious thing. And just the fact that she just keeps it secret for him and he's a Jedi, and like, I don't know, that just seems so weird and gross.
This is also in the realm of, it makes me question their relationship, which we already question plenty, right? But like,
yeah,
the things he has been saying and doing in their relationship and in trying to start a relationship with her, don't tell me that he's going to be a good partner.
Right.
They are red flags for abuse, manipulation, coercion. And so there's a part of me that like looks at that and then is like, was she worried about what would happen if she told?
That's fair. That's absolutely fair.
Right. Like, it does not, like, she also has a lot of power. She's a senator, blah, blah, blah. So it doesn't totally, like, exonerate her, but it does give me enough to, like, have a complicated understanding of what's going on with her.
Yeah. And that's true. Like, for the duration of this movie, she is essentially his prisoner, in the sense that he is a protector and she cannot do anything without his permission because he's the one assigned to keep her safe. And so there's a whole bunch of
She's definitely stuck with him. She uses it to say, well, if you're gonna protect me, you have to follow me and I'm gonna go there.
Yeah, so she isolates herself completely from anybody else, so it's only her and Anakin. Or however long, however many weeks or stuff that they're in that lakeside house. And then she travels with Anakin alone to Tatooine. So it's like this whole time she is alone with him, this person who we know to be violent and abusive and manipulative.
Yeah. It's super problematic. Yeah. I did really love, this is like one of those things that happens when you tell riddles to a bunch of adults and kids are present. Obi-Wan comes in. There's supposed to be a star system here, but it's not on the charts. Yoda. No star, but it's acting like there's, or no like star system, but it's acting like there's a star system there. I wonder what could happen. And the librarian also doesn't know, right?
Yeah. But and first then he has to bemean Obi-Wan, which I hate, but anyway.
Yeah. And then the child, the like youngling, He's like, somebody erased it.
Right.
Yes, in fact, somebody erased it from the chart.
Mm-hmm.
But I love that, like, that would be a riddle, right? Where is this star system? It does not appear on any of the charts. And yet there are planets and stars acting like it is there. What happened?
Yeah.
And adults are going to, like, not know. And then kids are just going to be like, oh, somebody erased it.
And I think in part it's because the adults are so self-assured about the security of the Jedi Temple that it would be unthinkable to them that somebody would have been able to break through the security and erase it.
I mean,
and even more unthinkable that the person who did it was able to break through the security because they were in fact a Jedi at the time before they mm-hmm. left the mm-hmm. Jedi Order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is also around where we get to Jar Jar as representative mm-hmm. for Padme in the Senate. He's Representative Binks. Mm-hmm. And he is either manipulated or in league with Palpatine in order to give Palpatine emergency powers indefinitely.
I think he's manipulated.
Which would be fair, because Palpatine is manipulating everyone at this point. The Jedi, mm-hmm. The Jedi, the Senate, everybody is being manipulated. Even Darth Tyrannus is being manipulated by Palpatine.
So tell me why you think, or why people out in the world think
it could be. Did you read the article that I sent you?
No, you sent it like while we were recording and then I forgot about it.
Well, the article, this is one of the scenes where where over and over again, Jar Jar Binks affects the events of the film of the prequel trilogy in a way that brings Palpatine to power. And we see this from the very beginning in the first film with his encountering of the Jedi in Naboo, and his clumsiness with certain things is what enables him to save the day. So the argument is that Jar Jar Binks's clumsiness is a well-executed front for those around him to see him as this bumbling fool, but actually through his clumsiness he's able to do all sorts of things. And then it also says that any time in the first film especially, we see this a lot since Jar Jar is a lot in that film, anytime we see one of the Jedi making an important decision, Jar Jar is waving his hand in the background as if Jar Jar is doing a mind trick on them to make them make that decision. And then in this one, he straight up is the one to suggest that Palpatine gets his emergency powers. And he is seen in this movie, every scene that he's in, he is accompanying Palpatine somewhere. So those are... And then when we get to the third film, we can talk about that even more, because he has minor appearances in that film too, which can add to that. So the idea is that Jar Jar is, if he is not the Lord of the Sith and Palpatine is his apprentice, since the other way around, that Palpatine is the Lord and Jar Jar is the apprentice. But some people will go as far to say that Jar Jar is the one Jar Jar is the one using Palpatine to get into power and is the mastermind, so... I'll link the article in the show notes. It does a much better job of going through all the evidence to support this.
Yeah. How do they justify that pairing when Tyrannus is right there?
The same reason. So there's supposed... So the rule of two that the Sith supposedly have mm-hmm. never seems to actually be followed, because Darth Tyrannus has Asajj Ventress as his underling the entire time, which goes against the rule of two. So the idea is that since the Dark Lord, supposedly one of their strongest powers is secrecy, doing things in secret, that, of course, Palpatine would either have another secret apprentice such as Jar Jar Binks, or Jar Jar Binks would secretly be behind Palpatine and would not let Tyrannus or other people know. And the timeline also doesn't match up for Darth Maul to have been, and Darth Tyrannus to not have been Palpatine's apprentices at the same time. So clearly, clearly Palpatine had at least two apprentices at the same time. So Palpatine clearly is not following the rule of two.
Right. Palpatine pretty much never does.
And we even see that. So the rule of two comes from, the origin of it is explained in the Darth Bane trilogy of books, which are not canon anymore, but still are referenced quite a bit. They're one of those like books that might as well be canon, because while it's not officially canon, canon material does reference the events of those books quite a bit. And Darth Bane was training two apprentices. He came out with the rule of two, but he started to mistrust his apprentice. So he started in secret to find another apprentice and stuff. So it seems clear from the beginning that the rule of two never really held much water. But
that tracks. Yeah. Also, I forgot to mention this when we were talking about the Tusken Raiders. At one point, Anakin's like, why did she have to die? And let's be real. The answer is so George Lucas can mess with Anakin enough to move the plot forward. Because women are just a tool for the plot moving forward for George Lucas.
Exactly. And that gets to episode 3 with Padme's death, which absolutely makes no sense to me. And it's clearly just to make the plot work.
Yep.
The way Lucas wants it to work. So yep. We'll get there in the next movie, though.
Yeah. I did love Padme's workaround, though, which we mentioned. But
yeah,
her being like, you have to watch, you have to protect me. Well, I'm going to help. So.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's one of those moments where we like really clearly see Leia in her.
Mm-hmm.
Or, I don't know, see her in Leia. But like, see that Leia is clearly her daughter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And even Luke.
Yeah.
You know, for a boy.
Right. For a male Jedi.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Indeed.
While we're kind of on this, though, I want the motivations of all... This is a movie where the motivations of all the characters start to become very unclear to me.
Mm-hmm.
In theory, Palpatine is trying to start a civil war, and he's behind both sides in order to gain further power and emergency powers and to destabilize the Republic. And the Jedi Order.
Which is why Tyrannus would actually make a much more appropriate name for him than for the actual Darth Tyrannus.
But, I mean, since he has been insidious in his plans.
It's true. Insidious also works for him. They all work for him. They don't work for Dooku.
So that part kind of makes sense. But Tyrannus, Dooku, seems to actually... And we get this in the Clone Wars, too. Like, he certainly is an asshole and a jerk and abusive and manipulative, all those things. But he also seems to truly believe in the Separatist cause. And we see this a few times in the Clone Wars TV show and in his book and stuff. But then that gets to, like, what do the Separatists actually want?
The real question. It is unclear. I don't know if I'm totally sold that he actually legit wants the Separatist whatever. Because he knows that Palpatine is Sidious, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he knows
that... He even says it to Obi-Wan. He says, what if I told you that the leader, that the person behind the Civil War is actually a person in the Senate who is... Yeah, has control of the Senate.
Yeah. And I think for me, part of it is he knows that Palpatine is doing this for power, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he as a Sith also wants power.
Yes. But he ultimately wants, I mean, if we take what he's saying to Obi-Wan on face value as representative of his actual intentions, which we can argue both ways because Yoda is the one who dismisses it and says, nope, he's just full of lies. But had Yoda actually listened to Dooku, he would have learned that he was telling the truth about the Senate. Mm-hmm. What Dooku says is he wants Obi-Wan to join him and he wants to talk with Qui-Gon. He wishes misses Qui-Gon's counsel because he's in a conundrum where he, and if he thinks if Obi-Wan is able to join him, he would be able to overthrow Palpatine. But to what end? Just for power for himself? Or if he's actually aligned with the Separatists, would he be able to make, in his mind, of course, dictatorship is not the way to do this, but if he were to become dictator, would he make sure that the Separatists would get what he would, what they would actually want? Because Dooku's homeworld of Sereno, where he is the count of, is one of the Separatist worlds. And one of the reasons they're Separatists is because they felt that the Republic failed them during a period of crisis.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know. It's hard because it just, I think his idea is they do the Civil War, Palpatine gets dictatorship, and he gets dictatorship. That's my impression. That he's like, okay with, like, we're just gonna be two dictators having, like, separate, I don't know, system things, federations of stuff.
We find from the Clone Wars, though, is the Separatists, there are a million different reasons why these worlds are joining the Separatists, including some of them, like following the Confederacy of the United States of America in that Civil War. Some of the planets joining the Separatist movement want to do so they can keep slavery alive and well. It's like, great.
Yeah. And that's the, like, I think the Separatists are like some Republicans, right? We just want to be able to do whatever we want. Hey, Yoshi. And cause whatever harm we want to cause and not be held accountable for our actions. Yeah. And that plays out in enslaving people. That plays out in taking over economies and planets and all of that stuff.
Especially since the Separatists are being funded by the Chinese in George Lucas's alien race alignment, but being funded essentially by the big banks of the Trade Federation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think you're going to talk about one of my things later, where I was like, is this like the Lions and the Christians, Gladiators, Hunger Games? I know it's before Hunger Games, but
yeah.
Yeah. Also, regarding the secret wedding.
Yeah.
That head thing, the veil, whatever thing that Padme is wearing is hideous.
Right.
Of all of the, like, cool, fancy things that Padme wears in her daily life, who designed her wedding outfit? Who picked that? The wedding dress itself is not bad. Not my style, but not bad.
Mm-hmm.
But the, like, intricate lace, no thank you.
Right.
No thank you.
But that also brings us to the relationships, and there's just a lot of relationships that we're noticing here.
I mean, there's the, like, compat and creepy Cullen aspect of Padme and Anakin.
Yeah, at one point as we're watching it, Emily even texted, for those of you listening at home, that, okay, Edward, something that Anakin said. Very much Edward Cullen. Go back, listen to our Twilight episodes. It's all along the same.
For real. It's awful. I think Padme and Ahsoka would make a great couple if we're already in the, like, ignoring age gaps realm of things.
Because Padme is, I think, 26 in this. And Ahsoka would be 11, so definitely ignoring the age gap there.
Yeah, but we're already doing that for Anakin and Anakin and Padme. So also Obi-Wan and Dex the person at the like diner thing.
Yeah.
I think there's something there.
So I forgot to mention this book earlier in the behind the scenes, but there's a book that explains the origin of their relationship called Obi-Wan, I think. Let me look at that. And it's really cute how they meet. Obi-Wan saves Dex's life, and then Dex saves Obi-Wan's life. It's kind of back and forth. See if I can.
It definitely gave me the feels from The Return of the Jedi, which I just finished. I just read the story today, but in From a Certain Point of View, The Impossible Flight of the Ash Angels. Like, it was giving those vibes, and I was like, you know, because he kind of blushes and looks a little bashful when he sees Dex. It's just cute, and it would be so adorable.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
But I do think this one.
It's called Padawan by Kirsten Wright. That's the name of the book.
Okay. Anyway, okay. We don't have to do it today because I did not prepare for this because I just thought of it. But I kind of want to do it, the game that's like fuck, marry, kill or something.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah. Right? Because like, but for the characters, right? So for Padme, who is the fuck, marry, kill? For Obi-Wan, who is the fuck, marry, kill? Who? Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Padme literally marries Anakin for some God knows why reason. So I guess.
I mean, okay. That.
Although I feel like if they had just fucked, that probably would have gotten.
That would have been so much better system, for their life.
And then they could have moved on.
Yeah. If we're doing Padme and age doesn't count, I would fuck Anakin.
Kill
is the kill Palpatine? Who you would kill the person? The person you would kill or the person you would kill with? Because we're in a war now.
Yeah, that's true.
Because I could see her killing with Obi-Wan.
Mm-hmm. Which she does, in fact, do in the gladiator scene.
And
then marry Ahsoka for you? Is that it?
Yeah, I'm just going to ship them.
I love it.
What about you?
Obi-Wan and Anakin definitely have a BDSM thing going on throughout this movie, just to be completely clear.
Yes,
about
my
that.
Master.
Yes, master. Yes, master. As you wish, master. So there's like some dom sub thing happening there. And I truly think that Obi-Wan would marry Anakin if that were allowed. They already seem to be kind of an old married couple, as you mentioned.
I literally, like, commented that. I was like, they're just, like, an old bickering married couple.
I feel like, fuck, who? I don't know. I feel like Obi-Wan and Dooku, if they fuck, they would probably get some of that tension resolved. And then kill with, like, kill alongside, because I can't see Obi-Wan wanting to kill anybody in this movie until Dooku at the end. I think he would want to kill alongside Padme as well. Like, he seems to really enjoy having her back and her having his back in the movie and stuff.
Yeah, they work well together. I think, so I'm going to make the fuck also the kink part.
Sure.
With that. So I would put Anakin in the fuck category. Yeah. With Obi-Wan. And I know, like, the other stuff that we've watched, there's that one person that Obi-Wan would, of course, marry. But I also...
Satine or something like that.
Yes, Satine. But I also wonder about Mace?
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know Mace well enough, but I feel like there's something that could be there. But really, Obi-Wan... No, that's what it is. Okay. Obi-Wan would marry Dex.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. That's who I go for Obi-Wan's marry.
Now, my personal fuck, marry, kill
in
this one. Of course I'd marry Obi-Wan. I've made it quite clear my love for him. Kill Anakin, hands down. Get that man, like, come on. Kill him,
not kill alongside.
Yes, kill him. Get. Okay. He ruins a galaxy for two generations. Kill him. And fuck Padme.
Okay. Oh, wow. I hadn't thought of this. It's hard because I love Yoda. And I can't quite figure out, like, what particular role. Because part of me is, like, kill alongside Yoda, which is to say both of us would hate it and would probably, like, not kill. Like, find ways to avoid killing alongside Yoda. I would definitely kill Anakin. If it's, like, kill as in no more life for you. But, yeah, the, like, I think I would fuck Obi-Wan and maybe marry Padme. But also I could see doing that with Yoda. So
yeah, sure. I mean, we live in a world where polyamory exists, so the options are limitless for whom you can marry and or fuck.
It's true.
Be more than one.
Perfect. Perfect. That's what I'm going with.
Yep.
I did not anticipate playing this game tonight. Yeah. Okay.
I guess we can move then into our deep theological discussion of the day from that from that funness. The three persons of the Trinity. Who would you fuck, marry, and kill? Kidding. Anyway.
I mean, Jesus, right? We'd all kill Jesus.
I'm totally using that as a soundbite. No, I'm not. Let's get Emily
I mean, from. It'd be okay. That
He'll
particular soundbite
is fine. Okay. He'll just come back. It's all good.
Yeah. It'll be fine. It'll be like a game.
Love it.
Yeah. So, speaking of violence. There were a bunch of interesting moments, particularly for the Jedi and the Jedi Council, around violence and war in this one. Because we've talked about it in, like, the Clone Wars. I think even in the Ahsoka arc in the Clone Wars. So we've talked about it a lot. But the space of what is the role of Jedi? And we talked about it in our last episode of, like, part of why they do all the spinny lightsaber things is because it's more like Tai Chi. It's more like the ritual and the motions than it is like the violent fighting in battle kind of thing. And at one point, Mace, when they're talking about, like, the possibilities of war, Mace Windu says, if it comes to war, there aren't enough Jedi, and says, we're keepers of the peace, not soldiers. Which I put dot, 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 for now.
Right.
But I think this is, like, a point that they don't actually take the time they need to take to reflect on.
Yeah.
Because in the like, other spaces and realms of things, like, they just jump right into it because they're doing emergency power. The only way to get anything through the Senate is to do emergency powers. And so then it just snowballs, and all of a sudden they're in the Clone Wars. Right? Like, literally Yoda's going to check on the clones and comes back with an army.
Right.
And then, so that's, like, the one spot. And then the other place that it comes in is at the very end, when Obi-Wan says that they had a victory because of the thanks to the clones, and Yoda rightfully says, no victory. The dark side has fallen on us, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, that this is no victory. This is not, like, they may have won this battle, but this is the beginning of a war, and literally no one wins a war. Wars are not won. They're just not lost as terribly.
And then just to the thing that Yoda says right after that is the quote that Claudia Gray made fun of when she was talking about how Yoda doesn't say a single wise thing in the prequel trilogies, because Yoda says, begun the Clone Wars have. And she's like, There's nothing wise about that. It's like, okay, yeah. Yoda.
Yeah, true.
But that also kind of gets into a kind of reoccurring theme I picked out in this one as well, which I think is a reoccurring theme for the entire prequel trilogy with the massage. Sorry, I was reading your point as I was trying to talk. With the shadow of the dark side being able to prevent the Jedi from having a full grasp of the situation to the point that Mace even says, should we tell this Senate that we no longer have this clarity to be able to like guide our decisions and stuff? And Yoda says no, because right now the only people who know that the Jedi have lost that are the Dark Lord and the Jedi themselves. Which, not very good on transparency there, Yoda, but okay. But like, so this kind of sense that the Dark Lords of the Sith are somehow shrouding their intentions, but not just their intentions, but shrouding enough of what is happening in the galaxy that the Jedi just have no ability to like perceive what is happening. And that becomes very clear when they just keep getting caught up in these snowball things you're talking about, and they don't realize what's going to be the end result of this until it's too late.
They get so caught up that they can't do the like zoom out, stand on the balcony and look down at the playing field kind of thing. That is literally their job in their role in the government, is to like have the big picture and hold the big picture. And instead they become soldiers and generals and all of that. The misogyny. The dismissiveness. So much. We've hinted at it multiple times. It is everything. Right? Mm-hmm. Like Padme. I think Padme has the Force. Just nobody cared to notice.
Yep.
And she had and it's played off, I think, as intuition.
In the lore of Star Wars, everybody has the Force. It's only Jedi and Force users have a mastery over it that the typical person does not know or does not know how to intentionally access. So that is my way of saying I agree with you, and there's lore behind it. That looks very good.
Okay, yes, everybody has the Force. And also, Padme has it special, but not special enough to be a Jedi.
Yep.
And that's the place where, like, I think probably happens to most of the women who have more Force than usual, is it gets channeled and interpreted as intuition, because that's what we do to women. We dismiss things as intuition, mother's intuition. But she says, like, I think Count Dooku did this.
Mm-hmm.
And the Jedis are like, meh, he couldn't. He's a Jedi. Literally, Jedis are trained to kill, y'all. And somehow he's a Jedi means he couldn't assassinate anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have not met yourselves. Ever. And she's right.
Yep. I agree with you. And, I mean, spoilers for our Ahsoka BooTube for the actual TV show that will be coming out in April. So all of y'all should become Patreon supporters to listen to that.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things I love about that show is that Ahsoka says that some people are born with extra talent to be a Jedi, but anyone can be a Jedi. And she trains Sabine in the ways of the Force, even though Sabine does not, from the outside looking in, does not have that particular talent. And yet Sabine is still able to master the Force enough to do a Force push in one scene and all sorts of stuff. So it's clear. So I think you're onto something about that intuition thing, because otherwise Sabine probably would have been considered a Jedi too when she was a kid.
Also, she's a Mandalorian, which feels like extra complicated to be chosen as a Jedi.
True. Since the Mandalorians and Jedi supposedly hate each other.
Yeah. I mean, she also was born in a time when the Jedi weren't picking people anymore. So there's that.
But... oh, I guess that's right. For some reason, I thought she was old enough that she would have been like a few years old when.
I mean.
Or, I don't know. It's not clear.
I don't think she was.
Yeah.
She was old enough. She might have been. I don't know. But also then, like, we get the super creepy line from Anakin of, I can sense everything going on in that room.
Mm-hmm.
Creepy McCreeperson. Yep. They assume the assassin is he, which, like, happens a fair amount in some shows and movies where there's, like, a surprise at different pronouns, at somebody not being a man. And that's partly to, like, emphasize the egalitarian nature a lot of times. That's not the case in this. They're just being misogynists. And then,
And at this point, too, speaking of that, the fact that the both Jedi were assuming that the assassin was a he. At this point, also, the Jedi Council is almost all men.
Yeah, I was noticing that there was the one...
In The Phantom Menace, there were a lot more women on the council than there are in this one.
There was the one woman who has, like, her lip painted.
Mm-hmm.
That was, like, the only one I could see.
Yeah.
In the realm of Jedi Council this time. Yeah. Super. Yeah. So that's awful. And then the start of their relationship and Anakin courting Padme is Padme saying, please don't look at me like that. Anakin saying, why not? And Padme saying, it makes me feel uncomfortable. And then he responds with, yes, m'lady. And that's like his sarcastic, it feels like the sarcastic, abusive, isolating, gaslighty, manipulating person's, like, yes, ma'am. Yeah. Yes, m'lady. Ugh. He's just so creepy and so awful. And I don't understand how, unless it's like Stockholm Syndrome, which is not really a thing.
Yep. I don't get it either. This movie does a very shitty job of convincing us that there's any chemistry and actual feelings between them, except for Anakin's possessiveness for Padme. Mm-hmm. That's the only feeling that, like, legit comes through is his possessiveness.
Yeah.
We already talked about the queerness of our other relationships, so I'm not going to go into that. But there's a fair, like, beyond even just, like, slash pairing in this movie, like, the whole master-apprentice relationship just feels so gay.
I mean, if nothing else, it's just so kinky.
Right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and they're so much closer in age than I think you could literally, if any of these folks were actually younglings, right? Like, you could technically be a youngling while your master is a youngling and just, like, be starting and aging out, right? Like, they're not that far. They're not necessarily that far apart in age.
Yeah. Most Jedi who are humanoid, who are humans, at least given the range of a human lifespan, pass the trials somewhere in between the age of 18 and 22. Obi-Wan passed his trials at 21. And took on Anakin as a Padawan when Anakin was 8. But Anakin became a Padawan a little bit younger than is typical. Most become Padawans around the age of 12, which is around the age Ahsoka becomes a Padawan too. So in theory, one could take on a Padawan as soon as one becomes a Jedi Knight, and your Padawan would only be 6 years younger than you.
Mm-hmm.
If you're both human, given the human lifespan. And we actually see this happen in I keep bringing up the High Republic books, but they're so good. But Vernestra Rowe, one of my favorite Jedi in the High Republic series, is the youngest person to become knighted as a Jedi in history or something like that. She was knighted at the age of 16. And of course it's a woman, because women are the better Jedi, so much better than the male Jedis.
Yeah, the male Jedis just don't have what it takes. They need a bit longer to catch up to the real Jedis.
But she takes on a Padawan who is 14, so there's only like a 2-year age difference between her and her Padawan.
That would be weird.
Mm-hmm. We talk about this in our Clone Wars boot tube, so I don't want to repeat it too much, but I do want to, but, and I also think we'll talk about it a lot more in our Revenge of the Sith episode, because we see more of the clones there. We don't see much of them here until the very end. But the clones are bred to fight. And so that gives us a question about their autonomy and how they are treated in the galaxy, and basically treated as a servant class to the Republic, who are like basically cannon fodder. Essentially, they're treated by the Republic the same way the droid army is treated by the Separatists. But these are actually living
Well, and there is, in Clone Wars, the show, there is like an episode or an arc that has this one Jedi who has the best track record of winning, also has the highest body count.
Yep. And we also find out that he's a dark Jedi who gives his allegiance to the dark side of the Force at the end. Spoiler alert of that trilogy.
I mean, yes. But like, there is that aspect to it that is just so... And then like the Order 66, where we find out that like they've all been implanted with this thing to make them automatically flip the switch and attack the Jedi. And yeah, there's so much about breeding a clone army. Every single word. Breeding clone army. All of them.
Right. And that also, like, there have, especially like we talked about in, when did we talk about this? Oh, we talked about this in our Alien Resurrection episode. About
when we talked about Star Wars and aliens.
Yeah, about, but we were talking about, since Ripley is a clone in that one, about kind of the ethics of cloning, also the reactionism of cloning in pop culture to the cloning of the sheep Dolly. But around that time, there's all sorts of theological discussion about, would clones have souls since they are a clone of another living being, or do they not have souls and stuff like that? That's this weird dualism between body and soul that I reject personally. But still, it's like interesting theological questions about not just the ethics of cloning, because there are ethical questions to talk about there, but also just kind of what it means ontologically. Ontologically is a big fancy word for like to the core of one's being. To be a clone, an exact replica of somebody else. Is your life fully your own? Is your life somebody else's? Those kind of questions that theology continues to wrestle with. And that's one of the things I love about theology is the ability to wrestle with these questions.
Yeah, I think that ELCA even came out with a statement, a social statement around then on, I don't know if it was on cloning or if it was like broader genetic modification, genetic stuff.
And the last thing I have for this is each of the trilogies is kind of reacting. We talked about this before a few times, but each of the trilogies of Star Wars reacts to the time and place it's in. So the original trilogy is kind of a response to the Cold War and the USSR and all of those things. This trilogy is very much, especially this movie and Revenge of the Sith, are both reactions to kind of post 9/11 warmongering, all that kind of stuff. And we see this even more in the next film, but in this one there's like intentionally commentary on like the state of the political world at the time and this kind of rise. So in on one sense, Palpatine's rise to power is intentionally mirroring Hitler. Like George Lucas has said that, like he was kind of inspired by the rise of Hitler. But also it's very much this kind of rise of fascism, which we are seeing in the United States, both post 9/11, but even more so now, I think. And then the fall of the Republic into the Empire is intentionally kind of mirroring Rome, the fall of the Roman Republic and becoming turning into the Empire. That gets to your gladiator battle and stuff like that. And also the chariot race scene we have in The Phantom Menace, just very intentionally like kind of bringing to mind this kind of George Lucas said he was inspired in part from some of the biblical epic films that all kind of focus on Rome and stuff like that, from like Spartacus and movies like that.
Yeah.
And then also just kind of the imagery of this movie with Coruscant and the Jedi Temple is intentionally designed to be dystopian looking, very brutalist architecture, as opposed to like the very beautiful, a very different architectural design of a place like
Naboo,
for instance, mm-hmm. compared to the brutalist of the Jedi Temple.
Yeah. I do think that going back to what you were saying about Hitler and post 9/11 and all of that stuff, I do think it's interesting because there are, like, each of the trilogies are, each of the trilogies do have their own focus, their own emphasis in where they're at when they're created chronologically.
Mm-hmm.
I have a helicopter that wants to hang out with us. And this one of the things about the way this one reflects a post 9/11 also feels like it's not just like a fear-mongering thing, but an inevitability of war.
Mm.
That was definitely how the war in Iraq and Afghanistan were portrayed.
Yeah.
As far as I, like, could tell as a high schooler, right? But, like, mm-hmm. they were portrayed, by and large, as inevitabilities.
Yeah.
They had to happen. And the Clone Wars is decidedly an inevitability kind of situation. It is the Jedi literally talking about, like, we're not ready for a war. We don't necessarily want a war. I'm just going to check mm-hmm. these out. Emergency powers, army, clone army, we're yeah. fighting a war.
And especially inevitable because Palpatine is on both sides, behind both sides of the war. And that mm-hmm. is kind of a conspiracy theory about the Bush administration, which there is some there are pieces of truth to, but it's still unclear exactly what happened, where the Bush administration has been criticized for, well, rightly making shit up about Iraq. There were no weapons of mass destruction there and no mm-hmm. evidence of it, and yet they made that up in order to justify it. So it seems like mm-hmm. the inevitability was, the reason it was inevitable was because they were planting stuff so that they could justify their act. Mm-hmm. Like, they already knew war is what they wanted, so how do we get there? And that's also what's happening with the Palpatine. I want a war. How do I make the war happen?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I agree 100% with you there. Well, I guess I was thinking this would be a short episode, and here we are after 45 minutes. Because, like, our outline, literally, folks, is, like, shorter, significantly shorter than most of our outlines, yet we still ended up going, all good stuff, though, not in a bad way. Mm-hmm. But we can get into our Force lore, then. I totally forgot about this section, so you have some notes there, and I'll just agree with them, because that's what I would say, too.
So, the main things for me for Force lore is, like, the ways it are connected to that last battle between Yoda mm-hmm. and Dooku, that lightsabers can catch force lightning, and
also Yoda caught it in his hand.
Obi-Wan shows us, and so can Yoda. Yeah. Just
yep,
I love you know, it. Like you do.
Mm-hmm.
And then also physical disabilities and low mobility while, like, general walking around and movement does mm-hmm. not actually mean you can't do forced gymnastics.
Yeah.
And like, there's an argument that, like, Yoda was exaggerating the need for the cane and.
Yeah, which I don't buy. I feel like my understanding of how the force works in those is that one can draw on the force kind of like one might use caffeine or one might use a steroid or something, which will temporarily mm-hmm. give you added strength. But it's not something that's sustainable. So once you do that, after that battle, he immediately has to go back to his cane and looks even more exhausted than he did before.
Yeah, I was going to say, and it might be that, like, using a cane and using assistive devices actually allows him to use more force energy when fighting because he has those to rest in when he's done.
And to be fair, there was a critic, I can't remember who, when this movie came out, that was very, I love the Yoda fight scene. I think it's really cool. I think when I was in the theaters and saw this, I think it was even on opening night. Like people were, during that scene, like people just went wild in the audience. People loved it. But like a critic, I think rightly pointed out that it kind of undermines the message of Empire Strikes Back with Yoda, which is that greatness does not have to be a specific way of force gymnastics and fighting. The greatness and power of the force can come in other ways too, such as wisdom, such as being able to move objects and stuff like that. So I get that too. Like it's kind of putting Yoda into a specific mold of what a Jedi is, as opposed to this more diverse understanding of Jedi based on their differing needs and body sizes and skills and all that stuff.
Yeah, but they were going to do that to, I mean, they were going to do that to Yoda no matter what. Sorry about the helicopter.
That's all good.
They were going to do that to Yoda no matter what, because no matter what, he was going to become this master strategist for the war.
Yeah, but one can be a strategist without participating in the fighting, too.
I mean, I don't know. I think it was inevitable.
Yeah, agreed.
Not that it had to be inevitable, but they made it inevitable.
And especially like Luke's knowledge of Yoda being that Yoda was a great warrior. Well, that had to have come from somewhere. So it makes sense.
Yeah. So, Pace, what are you rating the film?
Okay, out of 10 Kyber crystals, I'll rate this 3. And the only reason it gets 3 are because there's one Kyber crystal for Obi-Wan, because I love Obi-Wan in this movie. There's one Kyber crystal for the Count Dooku Yoda lightsaber fight, which is pretty cool. And there's also one Kyber crystal for the Anakin Dooku fight, where Anakin briefly wields 2 lightsabers and does the same technique that he ends up teaching Ahsoka, and she does even better at it than him. So those are why there are 3, but there are literally no more than that.
One for each.
Yeah, because like honestly, even the movie, like it did not age well. It looks so bad because of the over-reliance on CGI. It just looks so bad.
It was right in that time where CGI was big, and so everything was CGI.
And like even when we were watching, I'm like, why did this need to, like I would text Emily, I was like, George, why did this need to be CGI? This could have just easily been shot with like real people, but like their clone.
The clones
were made out of CGI too, not even people in suits. Like most of the clones we see on screen are completely CGI. It's like, why? Just hire somebody to wear a suit. There's no reason for it.
That's like the when we got to that very last scene of the clones, and I texted and I was like, here, I thought the Clone Wars movie had already started.
Yep.
Because it really does look like the animated. Yeah.
And my favorite kill will be
Anakin's
pride, which only stays dead for a few minutes, but when he loses so badly to Dooku, love it. But then, of course, he gets his pride back really quickly, sadly. But
yeah.
What about you?
I don't. It's not a good one. I will give the opening, like the second assassination of Padme, a Kyber crystal. Mm-hmm. And I will give that final battle a Kyber crystal. And I will give Padme overall, but especially when she's like in the gladiator realm, a Kyber crystal.
Are you giving any Kyber crystals to the puns? Like when Obi-Wan says she seems to be on top of things when she's literally climbing up the tower.
I'll give a half a Kyber crystal to those.
There are so many puns in this movie.
Like I know.
C-3PO's like, I'm beside myself when his head is literally right next to his body.
I loved that part. Okay. Yeah, I love that part. Okay.
It got to the point where the puns were taking me out of the movie a little bit. Like, oh my God, this is ridiculous.
No.
Which to me meant Emily must be really vibing with this. So,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, I was supposed to be taking notes. Sorry. I'm petting dogs. Sorry.
Apology rejected.
Do you have a... Yeah. Do you have a favorite kill?
Oof. I'm not actually a fan of any of the real kills that happen.
Like the Tusken Raiders, not a favorite kill.
Not a favorite kill at all. Shmi, not a favorite kill. Dorme, not a favorite kill.
The Bounty Hunter, not a favorite kill.
I mean...
The first Bounty Hunter. The death of Jango Fett might be a favorite kill, though. When it's
I know, I was like, well, it's like the only place where you can kill a Mandalorian with a lightsaber.
Right.
Just clean decapitation. I was trying to remember if Padme killed any of the animals. Or did, like, any killings herself.
She definitely does a lot of blasted shooting at the droids and killing the droids, but I don't know if she killed any of the animals.
I guess I'm going to go Jango Fett.
Okay.
Fair. Because it was a, like, really good one, and I remember in Clone Wars when Boba Fett is, like, has his whole vendetta to kill Mace because Mace killed his dad.
Yep. Did you have any jump scares?
I don't think I did.
Yeah.
Actually. Yeah.
I think when I saw this in theaters, I might have had one. And it was when the Anakin's lightsaber was destroyed in the press thing. Because I was like thinking that like he got crushed, but no, it was just the lightsaber.
Mm.
But that was like in the theaters, and since then not. So that doesn't really count. So. Well, our next movie we already recorded, which was part of my confusion, but we recorded Alien Resurrection with Jeremy Cobb, such a great guest. So definitely tune into that episode next week, and we'll talk even more about cloning in that one.
Yes, indeed we will.
Again, how these two franchises seem to play off each other in weird ways.
I know. It's actually been really cool to see how they intermingle and stuff. And then in 2 weeks, We will see you all. No, we won't. We'll hear you all. No, we won't. We'll talk at you all for Star Wars Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith. So we're excited about that. And that's it for our show. Our theme music was by Matt May. Horror Nerds at Church releases seasonally on Thursdays. Please comment, rate, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Support us on Patreon and get access to exclusive movie commentary episodes, BooTube episodes, and more bonus content by going to patreon.com/horrornerdsatchurch. Starting at only $5 to sign up, it's cheaper than building a droid army. Or a clone army. Much more ethical. Follow us on social media, Facebook and Instagram at Horror Nerds at Church, and Blue Sky and Twitter at HNACPOD for all the latest updates about upcoming films, news, and other announcements. Until next time, please don't look at me like that. It makes me feel uncomfortable.
Or don't use a production picture of Obi-Wan and mistakenly think that it is Jesus.
Or do, because it's awesome.
Except Jesus was not white.
Yeah, it's true. But I love when people do that. It's so good.